Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Penses. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is very special. We're going to be getting into some political philosophy of religion. It's going to be really fun. It's a new area for me. It's a hole in my education, so I'm about to be educated today. It's going to be awesome. And it's probably a hole for a lot of you as well. We have with us Dr. Kevin Vallier, and we're going to be talking about his new book, All the Kingdoms of the World. The subtitle there is On Radical Religious Alternatives to Liberalism. So we're going to be talking about liberalism, anti-liberalism, post-liberalism, the battle between liberalism and socialism. It's going to be really fun. I'm really excited. So stay tuned to the end so you guys can become experts on all these topics. Before we jump in, though, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen on Patreon and YouTube members. You guys are awesome. That's the best way to support the podcast. If you guys want to see me continue to have scholars on to talk about their work, if you want to see me continue to have lights on in my home and feed my dogs, please consider becoming a Patreon patron or YouTube member. There's different perks at different levels of support. You can find the links in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at. And if you don't want to hear too much about athletic greens and stuff, then just support the podcast. That'd be great. All right. Well, let's jump in with Dr. Vallier and talk about religious liberalism. Let's talk about political philosophy and all the good stuff covered in his new book. Here we go. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man. This is awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited. I know this is a little different from your standard fare, but I think it'll be fun and fresh.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'd love to, since it is a little bit different, I'd love to introduce you to my audience a little bit more. Sure. How do you describe yourself? Do you think of yourself as a political philosopher, a philosopher who specializes in politics, or how do you think of yourself?
So I'm primarily a political philosopher trained in the analytic tradition, but I've always had a foot in sort of analytic philosophy of religion. But I was always the guy that worked on the religion and politics issues. I'm not done much as sort of straight philosophy of religion, but I know many people in the community, and I definitely, follow their work and follow all the podcasts and shows and stuff that talk about their stuff. I would say I'm a political philosopher, but I'm definitely in conversation with philosophy of religion. But I'm also in conversation with a kind of new movement within political philosophy that we call PPE, Philosophy, Politics, Economics.
Okay.
And so the way I do political philosophy is a little bit different than the mainstream, because I pay a lot of attention where I can to the social sciences.
That's awesome. And I could be wrong here because I don't know the literature very well, but it doesn't seem like there's a whole ton of people filling that space that you're working in right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more people who work on this in political theory, like in political science departments, and some in theology, but a lot in constitutional law. Mm-hmm. So there is this kind of like bigger law and religion community that sometimes addresses some of these deeper issues, but mostly tends to focus on sort of policy and legal issues, things right. Like religious exemptions and things like that. So there is a certain way in which, I'm pretty lonely in what I'm doing.
That's cool. It's really cool, but it's also, I'm glad that you're doing it. And maybe we can call some of the audience members up to it. If you're interested in this stuff, jump in, like start getting your chops in this field. Kevin, what did you do your dissertation on?
So my dissertation was actually on the proper role of religion in the life of liberal democracies. Oh, wow. So, we'll talk about kind of what liberalism is, but it is kind of associated with a kind of secular approach to political life, mm-hmm. where, religion is kind of like this scary or maybe just kind of a bothersome thing in politics that should sort of be kept out of it. And it turns out a lot of the most sophisticated sort of people in that literature started kind of with that position. And the very weird thing about the subfield is that most people change their minds and in the same religion-friendly direction over time. So these include John Rawls, Jürgen Habermas, are the two most famous philosophers who actually changed their minds in the religion-friendly direction. I wrote against the privatization of religion and politics completely. I do think, for instance, like Supreme Court justices should reason in the language of the Constitution, like, Catholic Supreme Court justice shouldn't be consulting a papal encyclical and deciding how to rule. But when it comes to being a citizen, you know, whether you're acting for moral or religious considerations or both, that's, you know, totally legitimate. So that's kind of what I wrote about and defended. And that became my 2014 book, Liberal Politics and Public Faith. Although that's entirely focused on the role of religion in liberal democratic societies, not sort of radical alternatives.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll put a link to that book in the description, folks, if you want to check that out. That'd be huge. As we get into this book, I was just curious, like, how did you get interested in religious anti-liberalism?
Well, I've been writing on the liberal tradition and interested in liberal tradition in one form or another since I was 17. And my political interests, you know, got going my very sort of senior year of high school, but also very much in the freshman year of college. And so for me now, that's, you know, been over 20 years. I also was not a Christian between ages 13 and 20. And I went to Washington University in St. Louis, and down the road was St. Louis University with Eleanor Stump, but also Richard Swinburne, who was on leave there for a year. And in part through the influence of the graduate students, I became a Christian.
Wow. And
so I had these kind of, they were left liberal commitments when I first got to WashU, and then they became what we might call like right liberal or libertarian commitments after that. And so, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, I was just fascinated by these kind of two schools of thought, and I had this interest in whether they hung together or not.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. And I had to set that aside in graduate school and, you know, when I was an assistant professor before tenure, because it was just too red hot of a topic, because I had heterodox views both in philosophy, in both religious matters and political matters at the same time. Like in the community, you can, they'll sometimes tolerate like one heterodoxy.
Sure.
Like as long as you're like an atheist, you can be a libertarian, or as long as you're a progressive, you can be a Christian. But if you were neither of those things, then it's a problem. So I just told myself, well, I'm fascinated by this question. I've been fascinated by this question since I was 18 or 19. Because I reconverted when I was 20, but I was on the way by then. And now I had a chance to write about it. And lo and behold, Oxford Politics decided they'd commission a book on the topic. And one day the invitation came to me. And so that was fortuitous, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome. So in the book, you talk about how religion and politics have always been with us recorded history.
Yeah.
Have they always been intermingled, or even now you think of like the West and how there's a separation between church and state. Is there a genuine separation? Have they always been intermingled? Just from your own study of history, have you seen a place where it hasn't been? Or
So let me tell three stories. I'll give three answers to your question that kind of fit historically. Very much atheist philosophy, evolutionary or theory of the evolution of religion, theorist, psychologist of religion, Robin Dunbar has published a book, How Religion Evolved. And, you know, I think religion is true, but I still think, you know, the truth of religion gets revealed through historical processes, as well as, say, scripture. And he says in the beginning of that book, we have no archaeological or ethnographic record of any society that does not have religious people in it.
Mm.
That as far as we know, there's never existed a fully secular society ever. Mm. So he decides, you know, and argues at length that religion is a kind of human trait. It's like having blue eyes or brown hair. Not everyone has it, but it's there and it's easily awakened. And there are some people that always have it. And so the wishes of many secular people that religion will go away. In the United States, we're not secularizing, we're de-Christianizing. If you poll the nuns and you ask what they believe, afterlife, souls, aliens, I know aliens might be like naturalistic, but I mean, come on, crystals, you know, horoscopes, you know, all this stuff. I mean, people don't just, they may leave Christianity, but they're not becoming, you know, scientific naturalists by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. Karma, everything happens for a reason, depending on how you,
Yep. Spiritual, not religious, you know, all of that stuff. So I think the religious impulse is just extremely broad. It's deeply embedded in almost every human being. And then, of course, with respect to politics, it's just obvious, right? Like even going back to tribes, the beta males have to unite to stop an alpha that is out of control. And I think that's in some ways where politics originated, is the abuse of tribal leaders and people trying to resist the tribal leaders with coalitions. So I actually think our political impulses go back hundreds of thousands of years. But they don't come to like full fruition until we enter agricultural societies, pagan societies broadly. But those societies didn't always link politics and religion directly. It's like Zeus is not morally perfect, right?
Right.
So what happens is you start to see, you know, really about 5,000 years ago, the evolution of moralizing religions, one that postulated that there was a deity or karmic system or something to that effect that governed the cosmos and that applied to every human life. And those, the great religions, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism in the East.
Zoroastrianism, you made a note.
Yeah, I mentioned not, because there was, we can't forget them because they were a big deal,
right?
Big, very influential, including influential in other religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and so on. So you have in the ancient world the transition from pagan regimes to what are sometimes called the axial age religions. They're the religions of, that had detailed theologies and moral perspectives. And those societies all create civilizations that, you know, they may spin through, you know, kings and emperors and different ethnic groups in charge. But the religions are still deeply shaping like every aspect of human life, art, architecture, music, worship, beliefs about the afterlife, rituals, on and on and on and on. And this was really the case without interruption until the 18th century, all over the world, as far as we know. And then the French Revolution happens. And in some ways, I think that's like the precipitating secularizing event, because there is now some historical evidence that France used to be a very large country in Europe. Some people think that their birth rate started to fall after the revolution because they were becoming less religious. And so what you start to get is first you get the sort of ideology of in the 17th century of liberalism, which early on is not anti-religious. It's like usually Protestant, actually. So like it figures like John Locke, who was, you know, a pretty serious Protestant Christian. In the 18th century, liberalism's preaching of religious toleration, the disestablishment of religion, the sort of erosion or elimination of aristocratic privilege, the support for the free market, which was central features of liberalism for the 17th to the 19th centuries. Start to say, look, people disagree about religion a lot, like Protestants even disagree a lot. And if we try to establish a religion, we're just going to have to use a lot of violence and society's not going to work as well. And you know what? We might actually violate the dignity of the person as made in the divine image. And so with, you know, it sort of starts off as a pragmatic argument, but then it gradually becomes a principled argument for the disestablishment of religion. But you know, and so the liberal tradition, you know, takes a variety of different stances towards religion, but whatever it's for the disestablishment of religion. That is, the state should not impose a particular religion as true. So you have all kinds of Christian liberals and they're for this. So like the American Baptists vote for Jefferson in part because they really want separation of church and state because they think the established religions of the colonies are really bad for them.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of this starts off as Christian ideas, as Protestant ideas, as intra-Protestant disputes. So liberalism is kind of a secularizing movement by kind of secularizing the state. But then there are other liberals like John Stuart Mill that are just like very opposed to Christianity, and want people to kind of stop being Christians in their private lives. And that starts to take a lot more shape in the 19th century. In the 19th century, you also get the rise of socialism. The socialism only arises in the context of the Industrial Revolution because of its sort of pro-worker status. And its focus on the nationalization of the means of production, that is the goods that make other goods, capital, like factories, mines. When socialism arises and proposes the social or government ownership of the means of production, capital, it also turns out to be a secularizing movement, but much, much more aggressively than liberalism. In many cases, they're trying to create entire replacements, doctrines for liberalism. Now, some liberals attempted this, but again, it was nothing like the degree of effort as socialism. And of course, among the threads of socialism, nothing was more aggressive than Marxist socialism, which is really only one thread of 19th century socialism, but that became dominant pretty quickly after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
Yeah.
And so what you see in the 20th century is liberalism and socialism just break out of Western Europe, and they spread everywhere, and the United States, they spread everywhere. And they bring the secularizing forces with them. So, you know, liberals are disestablishing religion. They're sometimes kind of trying pretty hard to privatize religion, like France, Quebec, and so on. Then you get the kind of secular democratic socialists that aren't Marxist, but you see in like Ataturk in Turkey, you know, engaging in pretty serious, severe secularization in Turkey, even abolishes that Islamic caliphate. It's a little bit like abolishing the papacy. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, India, you have the partition with Pakistan, and that's a Muslim nation, but India considered itself, identified itself as a secular state. But then you start to get in the Marxist-led countries, you know, Russia, you know, the Soviet Union, ultimately China as well, you know, North Korea, Vietnam, and so on. And you just start to see just the wholesale destruction of religious belief. And so a lot of people start to see, oh, look, religion is going away. It's becoming less influential in politics or what have you. And then socialism collapses. And also a little bit before that, we have the Iranian Revolution, which is also a very important event. And it's all of a sudden like these religiously infused political movements start to recover. Hindu nationalism had been building for many decades, but it, you know, became dominant in the late 2000s and over the last 10 years. Confucian revival in China is only a few decades old and survived Mao's anti-Confucian campaigns. And, you know, Orthodox Russia, and it's Russia returning to Orthodox Christianity, and Putin seeing himself as a kind of leader of, you know, the Orthodox faith politically, is a kind of like czar rather than sort of a secularizing Soviet dictator. Hungary turning towards more sort of Catholic anti-liberalism, Poland doing the same thing, and in a way to a greater extent. You know, and then you start to see kind of minority movements. But you see a lot of in the United States, sort of first you've got kind of got the moral majority, which, you know, but in particular, you know, you start to see it's kind of loosely called Christian nationalism. But then what's really happened and what's really striking is that many of these movements have developed pretty sophisticated intellectuals. Hmm. And these movements and these intellectuals have published like treatises and stuff. And I've read a lot of them and I write about them in the book. So what's happening is you've got these. The sort of rejection of liberalism and socialism, secularization of public life, because that's even the human norm.
Right.
It's just humanity returning to the spiritual and political norm that I think is built in. So we only ever thought that this was going to happen because, you know, people extrapolated Western European secularization to the world, and they were just misled because socialism was just suppressing the political expression of the great religions. So I expect these movements to grow and to continue and to become more powerful with time, especially as very religious people outpopulate secular people.
Right.
Yeah. It's going to be a very important trend in the United States and also throughout the world in particular. So
it's kind of a shocking realization, because I don't know if the secularizing folks or the secularists, those who are in favor of a strong separation or even diminishment of religion. I don't know if they were the loudest or what, but a lot of us were like, yeah, religion's diminishing. And then you turn around and you see like, wait, what's happening in Russia? What are you saying?
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
Oh, wow, it's all here. And I thought we were these modern folks who turned our back on religion. I know a little bit differently because I work on a college campus as a campus minister. And so I know people want to talk about God because I ask them and they say, yes, let's talk about God. But I'm even surprised by a lot of this. And like, mm-hmm. Confucianism in China, and every now and then I hear something about India and I'm like, holy cow, are you serious? That's insane. So do you think that it's been the religious impetus or whatever, like, do you think that was that just suppressed, or do you think it actually was like diminished in the folks of those time periods when socialism and this, I don't know if it's neoliberalism, we haven't defined that stuff yet, but when that liberalism was going through, was it suppressed, or do you think those people actually bought in and were trying to create like a anti-religious or free of religious utopia type thing?
So that's actually a pretty complex question. I do think that atheist belief took pretty deep hold
Okay.
In some societies, I actually think there are many, most Russians really were atheists.
Okay.
And I do think that most Chinese, that China is the most atheist country. And I think that Mao had that effect in part.
Okay.
So some countries, you know, it takes up. In other countries where there's socialist leadership, there's just all kinds of religious people under it. So, you know, you look at, for instance, you know, the Gandhis and so on in India, you know, everyone's very religious except for the elites. And a lot of them are educated in the UK, obviously, mm-hmm. and they're going to receive a pretty secular education. So there's some countries in which it kind of filters down to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some countries where it doesn't. But what's universal is the elites tending to adopt liberalism, socialism, or some hybrid,
mm-hmm.
As I would put it, their religion substitute, because they felt like, you know, liberalism and socialism were kind of, you could reach their conclusions from reason alone. Mm-hmm. You know, liberalism and socialism were very pro-science. And so that whole kind of like scientific secularizing impulse combined with a need for something like a religion substitute came together. It's no clearer than it is in Marxism, which of course describes itself as scientific socialism, but was anything but scientific. One of the most ferociously sort of like anti-open inquiry ideologies or systems of thought that, you know, ever existed. I mean, yeah. Many Marxists were far more aggressive and close-minded than many people of faith.
Hmm.
I mean, a lot of people were kind of getting their religion needs met, but lying to themselves about the way they were doing it.
Yeah.
So that is a complex question. I think there's kind of an interesting story in elites where there's a period of time where in the 20th century in particular, everyone thinks socialism is coming. Everyone thinks it's inevitable. It's just a matter of time and what particular form it will take. And it's amazing that there was like global, enormous agreement that socialism was the future and they were all incorrect.
Yeah. It makes it even more surprising then to hear that there's at least some places where the atheist ideology did take root, because then to see the swing is like, that's really fantastical. Like that
yeah.
The swing happened. It wasn't just the suppression lifted and, oh, it was already here the whole time. No, it was a big swing from this to that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's been a big swing back in China because to be a Confucian or to be influenced by Confucianism, it's kind of just a system of virtue. And there is sure. this supernatural power of heaven, Tian, but it's not necessarily an agent.
Right.
And so, you know, they're not moving to, say, theistic religion, although Christianity and Islam have exploded in China.
Right. Right.
And so they're nowhere near a majority. There's probably 100 million Christians in China, and there wasn't a century ago.
Yeah.
So there is that. Russia's interesting because while most people do say they're Orthodox Christians, a lot of them don't go to services. But it's also like the services are really long, so you kind of wonder,
yeah,
if they had their 45-minute megachurch, whether they would show up or not. But
yeah.
So it's hard to, I think, know. But I would still think, you know, there's still been a big sea change in Russia. I don't know if I'd call it like a full-blown religious revival. It may be more cultural. What we're really seeing, actually, in terms of really sincere conversions or, you know, and mass explosion of pieties in Africa, and then the indigenous religions are being replaced. So I'm actually expecting increasing Christian-Muslim conflict in Africa, and it's just going to, I think it's going to sort of stretch throughout the century.
Would you call that more in Africa? Would you call it more like a revival movement where it's actually happening like ground up, or is there like a top down? Because I know in old times, like the top down stuff would become like Santeria or something, right? They would still have their traditional
syncretisms.
Yeah,
syncretisms. Yeah. I mean, there's been a number of Christian thinkers that have kind of focused on the sort of global the new Christendom of the global South. And what exactly that comes to.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they kind of mix some heterodox stuff, but actually a lot of the kind of low church Protestants seem to clear out those beliefs. It's really the Catholics that allow more syncretism.
Okay.
So it kind of depends. Sure. I mean, like, you know, gods become like replace them with saints or whatever. Not that Catholics worship saints. They don't. But, you know, if you go to South America, for instance, you know, I just kind of picked up and integrated a lot of indigenous ideas. But one of the things also that's very common to this growing Christianity in the global South is their charismatics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. I mean, Africa is weird because there weren't as many kind of Southern Africa, like Sub-Saharan rather, Africa.
Okay.
Is that you didn't have the same kind of suppression movements to the same extent that you had, you know, kind of in the Northern Hemisphere. So That's not so much a reversion as a conversion.
Okay.
But those immigrants, you know, I mean, Africa's going very quickly demographically. And many, many, many immigrants, you know, are traveling to, countries all over the world, like the United States. And I've heard a number of Christians say, you know, look, we're going to expect missionaries to the U.S. from Africa, and we've already got them.
Yeah. Anglicans and yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's do some work on three words that I think will help the audience. Liberals, post-liberals, and anti-liberals.
All right, let's go. So I think of liberalism as chiefly a political tradition. It's a theory or a set of theories about what government should do. So some people think of liberalism as like a way of life, something that describes like the ultimate good and how to live and so on. And I don't think that's what most liberals are trying to do. They're trying to reform government and reform social and economic institutions. Only some liberals have this kind of comprehensive theory of life. Mm. Okay, well, so if liberalism is a sort of broadly political tradition, what are its core tenets? Some people have a kind of list of 5 or 6 or 7. I tend to focus on 4. So the first liberal principle is that of individual and small group freedom and protection from the interference by government. There are different conceptions of liberty that are thrown around. Some it's freedom from interference by others. Others like the freedom to live a rational life. Sometimes it's a mix. So that really, it really depends, but freedom is the first principle of the liberal political tradition. The next principle is equality, and liberals dispute the doctrine of equality. At a minimum, it's, you know, equal rights. That is, whatever rights we have, we all have them the same. Also, liberals have traditionally fought really hard against power inequalities. So first, to constitutionalize monarchs, to put them, you know, to get rid of absolute monarchy, to remove aristocratic privileges. Very big deal. Obviously, the United States, from the very beginning of the Constitution, you can't bestow titles of nobility. It's just barred. That's a very liberal approach. Liberals also supported increasing the franchise, right? So over time, letting people without property vote, letting women vote. So then, you know, you get this debate about economic inequality. And then liberals kind of split. And there's a sort of a lot of back and forth, particularly in the 20th century. But all liberals are for certain kinds of equality.
Is that between left and right liberals?
Yes. So left liberals tend to think that liberalism and liberal institutions and freedom from oppression and equality require the redistribution of wealth and the creation of things like unions and so on. Whereas some classical liberals or their revival in what we call neoliberalism or libertarianism tend to stress market freedoms and sort of argue against the need for the redistribution of wealth and defend free markets and so on. So the liberal traditions, you know, very, very much diversified, particularly in the late back half of the 20th century. Once fascism was defeated and socialism was sort of confined, liberals began this kind of fierce debate about, like, should we have a welfare state or not? How big should it be? And so on. So equality is another principle, but it's just interpreted in lots of different ways. The third principle is the ideal of toleration, right? So the idea that, you know, we should not necessarily be less certain about our own views. Some liberals do say, like, we're super fallible. You know, we make all kinds of mistakes. So we should, you know, listen to a diversity of viewpoints. Others give a more conscience-based take. So like Mills, more like the epistemic take, like we'll learn more. Whereas like, say, John Locke would say more, it's just like a matter of conscience. But whatever it is, we should disestablish religion or make it anemic establishment, like in the Anglican Church, right? The Church of England.
Yeah.
And we should tolerate first all Protestants, then that gets extended to Catholics and Jews with time, so theists in general, and then now we're starting to see its sort of full extension to atheists in like the field of religious exemptions, where non-religious people say get exemptions too. So there's this gradual broadening of the idea of religious toleration, and it's also being extended into the sort of moral domain. So, you know, we have to tolerate secular moral doctrines, you know, as well. So that's the third principle. So we've done freedom, equality, toleration. And then the fourth is a doctrine of what I call harmony of interests, or more minimally, mutual advantage. Liberalism is really different from conservatism and socialist traditions in that it's kind of the win-win ideology. So you're kind of always looking for ways of creating peace and having a very non-conflictual view of society, say relative to say Marxist socialism, where Marxist history is the history of class struggle. So it's just an inherently conflictual model of social order. The liberals are saying, no, we can organize things so everybody wins. We can have mutual advantage. We don't necessarily have to have class. Boom.
Clapping.
Yes. Good. So the third principle of liberalism, or the fourth principle rather, is the doctrine of the harmony of interests or mutual advantage. So liberalism is very much the win-win political ideology. You know, you see market liberals, neoliberals, or libertarians stress that, look, if we have the free market, like, people benefit each other, they engage in mutually beneficial exchange. You know, left liberals will stress more democracy. You know, if we had democracy, life would be better off. People would be more protected from private power.
It's not a zero-sum game, right?
Yes, yes. It's most fundamentally the anti-zero-sum political tradition.
Okay.
So it's those four principles that I think make for a liberal. They're interpreted in different ways. There's lots of internal disputes, but that's, I think, about what liberalism is. Okay, now, post-anti-liberalism. Post-liberalism is a pretty vague category. It includes a whole host of different people, depending on how much they're opposed to liberal political tradition in what way. But one of the things that unites post-liberals is that they attribute whatever the certain doctrines of liberty to liberalism that they think are mistaken and incompatible with a kind of communal human good. Very common to post-liberalism to say this idea of negative freedom, of freedom from the state, is a mistake. Because it individualizes or atomizes societies, undermines families, and so on. It's frequent for post-liberals to see liberalism as a kind of comprehensive doctrine or whole theory of life. They think that regardless of what liberals say about having more limited political ambitions, liberalism is a theory of life functionally, and it's a false theory because it's fundamentally, say, anti-Christian or anti-Muslim or what have you.
Okay.
So post-liberals have a very strong, intense critique of liberal society in terms of, you know, being too individualistic, too focused on autonomy, against community and traditional religion. They also tend to reject strong doctrines of equality they often friendly to the establishment of religion. So they're a little weaker on the toleration point.
I can see the religious impetus there. I wonder if are there secular post-liberals as well who would say, like, the thing that we have a problem with is maybe not the atomization of society, but the toleration of religions. You know, we need to go further in not tolerate them or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, once you start getting people that are worried about the liberal tradition on the left, they pretty much just fall under the socialism camp.
Okay.
And because socialism, you know, in many cases, sometimes we're friendly to liberalism, other times just we're incredibly hostile. Mm-hmm. And I think many on the left today, what I call like the woke left or whatever, they're very anti-liberal. But they don't all necessarily identify as socialists, but the more sophisticated of them, they're like, well, liberalism, you know. A lot of the radical movements with respect to race and gender and so on, they were opposed to liberalism because liberalism's kind of like a reformist mindset. It's not like exactly a revolutionary mindset in the same way as, say, socialism is. And so liberals would be like, well, we really need to think about this before we make a really huge change. We could make a huge change. We're not conservatives. We're open to huge change. We better be careful. And many of the socialists are saying, we can't wait, right? We got to have equality now. Okay. So many on the left, you know, they don't like liberalism for that reason. There's a whole bunch of other things, but the people who use the phrase post-liberal, they tend to be on the social right. And they do tend to be religious. Economically, they're more on the left. Or the center. But post-liberals tend to be much friendlier to the regulatory state, to the welfare state, than the liberal, at least the right liberal or classical liberal position.
Wow, that's fascinating. I don't know a whole ton about like demographics, and I love armchair philosophy type stuff. So like this is all brand new. Are post-liberals? Do you know if they're like, are they more millennials? Or are they more like, I could see boomers being more socially left, despite, you know, their own beliefs, but they also are like, hey, I can't wait for my check to show up from the government. And so I could see that, but I can't see like millennials being like that, but maybe.
So I think that the amount of post-liberalism grows as you go down the generations. They might not necessarily know that term. And I think that, you know, among like Gen Z, like you're going to see, I think a lot of left-wing anti-liberalism, but a lot of right-wing anti-liberalism. One of the reasons I wrote my book was to address young post-liberals and anti-liberals.
Okay.
So the post-liberals, one of the things they're vague about versus the anti-liberals is that they don't really have like a positive political ideal. They don't really have even a clear political program.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what they don't like, but they don't really know what to do. And so many of them will just say, yeah, I don't really know how to change liberal order except at the margins. I just know I'm against it. I know that it's poisonous and problematic. So you get people like Rod Dreher, who's a post-liberal, and, you know, he's sort of pushing this Benedict option idea as a kind of localist resistance of the kind of what some call liquid modernity, the idea mm-hmm. that, you know, like you dissolve all of these traditional institutions, they have to be kind of rebuilt from the ground up. Patrick Deneen's another such case, though I think of the last bit, he's transitioned to, well, I think more full-blown anti-liberalism. But then, you know, you have people like John Milbank or Adrian Pabst or a variety of people that, you know, they haven't really got a positive program. So they're post-liberals in the sense that they're kind of beyond liberalism as an ideology or what they think liberalism is, because I think they tend to be pretty mistaken about what liberalism is.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they've not really got a clear eye of the alternative. They want one, haven't quite got it.
Okay.
So that's at least what I call the distinction I draw between post and anti-liberals. The anti-liberals have a clearer idea of what they want. They reject liberalism more fiercely. So they tend to be sort of against any kind, like they're not worried about interference from government as much. They don't care about political equality at all. Mm-hmm. Many of them are like friendly to monarchy. They're against universal religious freedom entirely and want to go back to the coercive establishment of religion. They tend to have a very conflictual view of society, of seeing politics as a matter of friend versus enemy. So they're against all of liberalism's central tenets.
Yeah.
And basically all the anti-liberals on the right are religious. Okay. You have some Protestants and Eastern Orthodox, but the most prominent among the anti-liberals in this country are Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, unlike the post-liberals, they say, look, I mean, we had a model of civilization, a religious civilization, and this is something, you know, we have to be really careful about this, but that we really can restore.
Mm.
We really can make right. There are some anti-liberals that are more skeptical of the practicality of this than others.
Okay. Are the folks you have in mind, the anti-liberals in that movement, are they hangovers or holdovers from years back, from, you know, hundreds of years back, and it's just been like a consistent thread that the parents have been teaching kids? Or are these like new folks who are like, hey, I'm taking my faith more seriously, and turns out I think like I'm going to take my faith radically seriously, and I'm going to apply that to government as well? Do you have any sense of whether it's been
It's not a consistent stream at all.
Okay.
In the United States. I mean, the complication of Catholics in America is they've been oppressed most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always this vigorous debate within American Catholicism about sort of how much of the American experiment could Catholics take on. And so there's mm-hmm. always a range of disagreement. And there were always at least a small group of people saying, no, you like, there's something sort of fundamentally mistaken about the American experiment. But the kind of American friendly Catholics, you know, just totally went out. And by the time you have the Second Vatican Council, many of the American Catholics were quite influential in moving the Catholic Church's sort of public theology, maybe not exactly its dogma, sure. In a more liberal kind of like human rights regime, a radical, you know, total freedom of religion direction, which for the Catholic Church, you know, was new to it. So I think what happened with Roman Catholics is that they gradually became accepted by American society. So, you know, until Nancy Pelosi stepped down as Speaker of the House, we had a Catholic president, a Catholic Speaker of the House, and 5 Catholic Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, right. They're doing it in the politics.
Yeah. If you told anyone 100 years ago that that was going to happen, they would be like, no way, that's not going to happen. That was back when the Klan went after Catholic schools all over the country.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, yeah, people don't understand how anti-Catholic the Klan was. You know, the story of Catholicism in America is sort of them being on the outside and them being on the inside. But over the last 15 years, traditional Catholics have gone kind of back on the outside.
Mm.
Why? Well, one is their opposition to abortion, mm-hmm. Becoming more strong, and also more strong within the Republican Party. Got them more in trouble in the academy in particular. So many Catholic intellectuals, you know, having gone through the academy, went through it thinking, okay, look, you know, I've got views that people will think I'm a moral monster if I express them. And then with the LGBT movement in Obergefell in 2013, Catholics, you know, traditional Catholics were like, look, the only way to move forward is to give up my faith in politics and just to, you know, approach it like Biden or Pelosi and say, look, I've got my private faith, but it doesn't really impact my politics very much directly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's going back to like JFK and him saying, oh, I'm not beholden to the Pope at all. You know, I prioritize democracy or what have you. And so many, you know, Roman Catholics, younger Roman Catholics, especially in their 20s and 30s, but there's some older Catholics saying this too, say, you know what? The American experiment looked like a good idea in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, but that was just temporary. And so, you know, we need to go back to really understanding the American project in Catholicism as opposed. And in fact, the whole liberal ethos animating the American Constitution is something that has to be sort of changed and opposed at least one day somehow in one way or another.
Yeah. And I caught in the book a bunch of names I'd never even heard of before. And you're doing all this research into all these different mediums. I'm like, man, I had no idea. Because when I'm a Protestant, and when I think of these kind of movements, I think, well, Christian nationalism, whatever the heck that means, depending on who you ask, like that's who everyone's always worried about. And I'm in Chicagoland, and most of the Catholics I know are like, I will go to church on Easter and Christmas, and that's cool. And I'm Catholic, but you know, I'm Italian, and that's why, or I'm, you know, whatever. So to see that this is like a movement and it's got a name, Integralism, I think is right. Can you flesh that out for us? Like I was totally unaware of this.
Sure. So, it's a funny little story that what happened, but it fits with the broader narrative I was telling about the revival of faith-infused political movements, because as sort of Catholicism dies in Western Europe, there are several English theologians, political and philosophers, but the leader of these is Thomas Pink, who's a spectacular philosophical historian, theorist of the will, sort of master of church history. And he recognizes that, like, the Catholic Church is in decline. Rapid decline. Why? And the view he came to was the idea that the church does not really take itself seriously as a political institution, in a legal institution. It's an institution that's meant to help promote salvation, but by reigning in sin and actually holding people responsible for sin. And he thinks actually that's going back in church history. That was very much how the church thought of itself for centuries. But if the church thinks of itself as a polity, the state is also a polity, then there's this really fascinating question, which is superior and how do they relate to each other? Mm-hmm. Now, if the church has a nobler end, salvation, there must be some sense in which just the state's superior, not in the sense that it rules in every respect. We know from scripture that God ordains the secular power directly, or the non-religious power directly. And so, you know, in the medieval period, but really during the Counter-Reformation, when you get Francisco Suarez and Robert Bellarmine articulating this idea, that only came to be called integralism in the 20th century, late 20th century, in particular, where you look, God ordains kind of two powers to promote the temporal common good on the one hand and the eternal common good on the other, the state and the church, but that they should have this orderly connection, as Pope Leo XIII put it, like that between the soul and the body. So here the church is the soul and the state is the body. It gives us its ultimate purpose. It animates it. And what it means is that a Christian state can kind of integrate, hence integralism, with the church so that the church can direct its policy in spiritual affairs. Mm. So, for instance, maybe the control of heretical books, heretical communications, the punishment of heresy and apostasy. If this sounds a little bit like Islamism, it should. There are some important similarities between these views. Mm. So essentially, you have the Catholic legal code, the code of canon law, and the state civil law would sort of support and back it in various ways. And this is how many regimes operated in the medieval, high Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, early modern Catholic regimes, and so on. So, you know, Pink's on really good ground in thinking that, this was something that was a very sort of popular, widespread view among Catholic theologians for a really long time, until really the late 20th century when, the early 20th century when people really started to kind of want to be more on board with the liberal kind of international order, especially after the Second World War. And so Pink is saying, you know, look, we lost this understanding of ourselves and we need to recover it so the church would recover it. Now, what's important about Pink and the other British integralists is they had no political ambitions at all. This is like 2008, starting in 2008 or so. No, it was a very small renewal movement within the Catholic Church. But then it got imported to the United States, and it did something very different there. There are a group of integralist intellectuals, which include actually some people your listeners may have heard of, but I'm not at liberty to say who they are, got involved in a Facebook group in 2012, 2013, and were starting to discuss these issues. You know, people have gone to Ivy League institutions or Catholic institutions like Thomas Aquinas College, and they start saying, okay, you know, we're against liberalism. We think it's acidic. We don't like economic liberalism, like the market. They don't like political liberalism. What are we for? And they start to kind of reconstruct what they're for. And they begin a blog, The Josiahs, that's actually remarkably designed to ultimately produce edited volumes, which there are two now. So the blog posts all kind of fit together. So it's a very small movement. I mean, you're looking at a few dozen people. But then they start to engage on Twitter and start to bring more people in. And then once Trump is elected, the group splits. And the left-wing folks kind of peter out. And the right-wing folks explode. And they start to convert people left and right. So now I would say there's thousands of Catholic integralists, most of whom I think are under 30.
Wow. Okay. Well, and they're mostly leftovers. They're mostly the right wing side of it. Do these folks also not like the market, like the free?
Yeah, they're pretty skeptical. But they're many of the early left wing integralists were very anti market. But the right has moved in an anti-market direction in a big way. So, you know, one of the leading kind of like Catholic integralists, Sorabo Mori, he's the most famous of them. He's just written a book, Tyranny, Inc., where he essentially takes a left-wing view about the way that markets are tyrannical. So that just came out yesterday, August 15th of this recording. So they're very much moving in an economically left-wing direction, partly, I think, strategically, because they have so many enemies on the new right. I mean, with when Trump got elected, all of these kind of like minority strands and conservative thought like got a breath of fresh air because it was such a defeat to traditional Reaganite conservatism. Trump just was so different, to put it neutrally, that it was like opening Pandora's box, basically.
Was everyone trying to grab on and say like that, this is our movement? These are our people,
yes,
like arguing
that's
over
right.
wands and stuff?
Exactly. Trying to say, okay, who are going to be the intellectual leaders of the sort of Trumpian and post-Trumpian right?
Okay.
There's a bunch of different groups, and we don't have time to sort of go through them all.
Sure.
Catholic integralists were one of them.
Okay.
And the advantage that the integralists had over all the other factions is that they had this extremely rich tradition of philosophical theology behind them, and they could draw on it. And so in many ways, they were just a lot more smart and careful in terms of their view. Like, oh, we'll go read like this encyclical from the 19th century, you know, or go read Aquinas, you know. He has this little book on kingship, De Regna, which is, you know, if you read it in isolation from his other works, looks really integralist. So the thought here is, you know, they've got all this intellectual heft all of a sudden. And they're very influential among elite Catholic thinkers, especially on the right, to the point where there are many like young Catholic like law students, Catholic seminary students, Catholic philosophy students, you know, all over the country, where if you ask them, they'll say something like, well, yeah, but maybe I wouldn't go as far as like Harvard Law Professor Adrian Rule. But like, I'm very sympathetic to integralism. I'm very open to it. And I just, you know, hear about and listen to and talk with, you know, a lot of such folks who've been just totally alienated from American society, blame that on liberalism, and want a radical alternative. And of course, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, I think more than any other religious organization has really laid out historically what that might look like. Now, I find this, you know, like stunningly unappealing. But for whatever reason, a lot of younger Catholics, think it's the way to go.
This is really fascinating. I'm sure that a lot of my listeners, would identify this, and probably in the same way that you're saying, where I don't go as extreme as this or that, but yeah. So folks, if you're listening, let me know in the comments. You don't have to like out yourself or anything, but, that would be
there are many shy integralists. There are many shy integralists.
I can imagine.
There's a lot. Yeah.
There, the market thing is really throwing me for a loop, because I've seen, the libertarian movement, those folks switch into like, anarcho-capitalism, whatever that means, and anarchism, and then go like, it's either between like minarchism or anarchism and straight up monarchy. And I'm like, wait, what are you saying? What's going on? I thought you were American, bro. And then So I can see that trend, but they're still like, no, the market's a good thing. The free hand, you know, we need to free it more.
Yeah, yeah.
So for people to be like, no, like we need the Pope or someone or the Catholic Church to be in charge of the market is like brand new to me.
Yeah. So this is actually really fascinating because, you know, I've been involved in one way or another in sort of classical liberal libertarian politics again since I was 17. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching the movement very carefully, reading its great thinkers, writing, you know, trying to do research into them. I read a lot on F.A. Hayek. I used to have a very strong interest in anarcho-capitalism, particularly when I was a lot younger, when I even identified as one
for
4 years, age 17 to 21. And they
look to Tolkien and they'll say like, he's one of our thought leaders in this. And it's like, dude, who can argue with Tolkien?
So it's super strange, but some of the first integralists, they didn't call themselves this, were actually defectors from libertarianism. Okay. So Ed Fazer is the one you're most likely to have heard of. He's a sort of Thomist apologist for, like, he's written against a lot of the new atheism and so on. He didn't call himself an integralist, but, you know, he kind of introduced, he wrote this really nice book on Nozick, Robert Nozick, the great libertarian philosopher at Harvard in 2002. But he quickly sort of decided, well, you know, libertarians talk about natural rights and natural law, but if you go and read the natural law theorists, they're not libertarians at all. Yeah. And so I think there's just like this intellectual pipeline from libertarianism to these kind of Catholic views, in part because of the similarities on natural law, in part because of having like weirdly common aesthetic sensibilities, like Tolkien, for instance.
Yeah.
And because the libertarians like Tolkien because the Shire is stateless.
Mm-hmm.
And in the introduction of the state toward, you know, at the very end, is seen as a terrible development.
100%. The wheels of, you know, economy crushing.
Yes.
And that's Sauron. And yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. But Tolkien's no libertarian. You know, he's a medievalist. He's an anti-industrialist. It's like a Luddite in a lot of ways.
Right. Nature's good and the Shire's good and all the industrial.
Yeah, exactly.
Are bad. Tearing down trees and totally.
Yeah. 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 So there is this, I think, intellectual pipeline, but there's also like the troll contrarian pipeline, which is, you know, like 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s, especially the Ron Paul campaign in 2008, 2012, you get all of these converts to libertarianism. And all of a sudden, libertarianism has like 10 times as many members.
Yeah.
But many of them are like conservative Christians and they aren't like fully on board.
That's me and my brother. That's just it. Yeah.
This is, yeah.
2012. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, in 2016, you know, before Trump, like Time has this like picture of Rand Paul and is like the libertarian moment and all of this stuff. And then Trump gets elected and boom.
Just crushed.
And then after COVID, the hardcore like paleo libertarian anarcho-capitalists take over the Libertarian Party and completely break with like the libertarian intelligentsia and like philosophy, economics, media, think tanks. And so now the movement, in my view, is like fractured and basically dead.
Yeah.
But what happened was young people came in and the way to be contrarian was no longer to have these radical economic views, to have these radical cultural views. Yeah. And my theory about why this happened, and you know, is that essentially these younger kids grew up and there was YouTube. And in YouTube, if atheists said theists were dumb, you could go just like watch a debate where that was false.
Yeah.
Because all the good analytic religion had filtered down into Christianity more broadly. And so you had the atheism, theism wars on YouTube. I was a little old for that. I didn't start, you know, because I, you know, I was born in 1982. So I had the internet, but only after I was 12. And, you know, all that stuff starts to happen, you know, at the very least after 9/11 when I'm in college. And, you know, a lot of those debates. And so you realize, oh, wow, theists can really defend themselves. I didn't expect that at all. New atheists basically deceived me. Or just didn't know what was going on. I cannot believe there's all of these resources. And so I think what happened to younger people, it's like, well, being a theist is no longer for dumb people. Like you almost never hear that anymore. Libertarian movement 20 years ago, the Randians, it'd be like, oh, you're a theist. You're irrational. Huh, that's a shame, right? But now, I mean, you talk to, you know, a 20-something theist libertarian and they could just boom, 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 boom. Like they're just in a super good shape.
Yeah.
So, but then once you opened up theism within libertarianism, this weird thing started to happen. That like Christian theological stuff started to be in contact with libertarians, and libertarians had nothing to say. Nothing. And they couldn't answer the spiritual longings that many of these younger people had. And they said, look, libertarianism's radically incomplete. And it tells me things that I can't bring my spirituality in politics because it's all about markets. It's all about property rights.
Yeah.
And so people say, okay, look, if I'm a Catholic anti-liberal, I have a theory of human life, of social life, and it's complete. It gives me answers on everything. It even tells me the meaning of life. Libertarianism by design doesn't do that.
Right.
And so that's why I think the way it's going on the pipeline. There's this intellectual pipeline through Aquinas, and then there's this kind of contrarian pipeline through people that are, you know, perfectly willing to be kind of bring their religion and politics.
Mm. That's really fascinating. That's really, I'm trying to figure out which line of thought to chase, but there was for my brother and I, a huge catalyzing force was Don't Tase Me, Bro. Do you remember that one?
Yes,
and that,
I do.
And that was like civil liberties. And we were like, markets are cool. And we're just kind of like, leave us alone. And all the other libertarian folks were like, markets. And I'm like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
But also like not anti-police, but anti-police brutality was like a huge one for a lot of us. We're
That's
like,
right.
Don't, my brother had a shirt, Don't Tase Me, Bro. And it had a taser on it. And that was a whole thing.
Yeah.
We'd say it. And that kind of disappeared. And that was weird that it just like left. And then Black Lives Matter came up, but then you're not really allowed to join that movement and say those kind of things and say, hey, we've been thinking about this for a while as well, which is weird. I don't know. Any idea why it disappeared or where it went or what?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's because the culture war tore the libertarian movement into pieces.
Okay.
And so many libertarians became Team Red, and Team Red hates BLM.
Yeah.
I think it's actually just that simple. And now you have all these libertarians that are just like hardcore anti-woke. Like back in my day, in my halcyon days as a teenage libertarian, we were third way.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know, we weren't involved in the culture war.
Yeah.
We allowed cultural disagreements within the movement. We disagreed about abortion. We disagreed about religion, but we were going to give freedom to people so that they could live out their own cultural values. Like that was our thing. And I still like that part.
Yeah. Know your rights. Know what you can do where. Some of these folks just go around filming police officers. I'm like, all right, well, you might be asking for it. But
in,
also,
in my day, opposition to Iraq and the war on terror was similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what you're talking about was continuous with this opposition to national security state at every level.
Yeah.
And I mean, the interesting thing of the Catholic Integral is they're not like super pro cop or anything. They don't really talk about it. They don't really care.
Okay.
What they care about is, you know, like, spiritual life, like eternity, and gaining political power in order to bring that about.
Mm.
So they are pro-state, usually, although there are some anarchist-leaning integralists, but the dominant strand today is statist.
Okay.
So the story of the transition is, and I'm just telling one story, but I'm only one of the only people that has a story. So, I care about like every side of this transitional moment over the last 10 years that has completely changed the political landscape of sort of young people that are not progressive, but that are reflective anyway.
Yeah. Well, so I mentioned this to you off air, but one of the things that I liked about the book, and I haven't given it, you know, the thorough analytic read right now, but I've looked it over and I really appreciate it, read the first chapter. So you also make arguments. And one thing that I lament about some of my philosopher friends when they turn to sociology or history is like, I'm a sociologist now. Like, no, dude, you gave up your birthright. You're still a philosopher. Be a philosopher, Charles Taylor. But sorry for folks who are really big into Taylor, but I'm sad about that sometimes. I wanted to look over just maybe three arguments. Maybe we can't cover them all, maybe at least one, but you have this transition argument that integralism serves as a poor guide for social reform, stability argument. Integralism predicts disagreement and future conflicts, and then the justice argument that maybe somehow it's internally inconsistent, or you know it gets justice wrong. Do you have one of those that you want to give to us? Could you give us all three? What do you think?
Yeah, I can give all three. So you know what we're going after in the book, try to treat fairly, is the integralist ideal, right? So like you can beat up on any view by saying, well, in practice it doesn't work as built, right? And I just didn't think that was the most interesting thing. I wanted to say, is integralism true even when it's working according to its proponent's plan?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So the three arguments that I give, the transition, stability, and justice arguments, are premised around critiquing the ideal. So the transition argument says there's no way to get to the ideal without violating Catholic moral teaching. So the problem is that you have to both take over the state and make it Catholic. You have to convince the church to become integralist again.
Oh, sure.
And then you have to convince them to cooperate. That, and you have to do that, and you can't just kill lots of people who disagree, like you by Catholicism's own lights. So what I say is, transition argument is that going to integralism today in any large-scale pluralistic society is going to be morally infeasible. Like, you can do it, you can make it happen, but it's going to be violent. It's going to be ugly, really ugly. Or you can respect Catholic moral teaching, and then it's infeasible. So that's the transition argument. I go very carefully through Adrian Grumol's strategic writings, because he's written a bunch, as Harvard Law professor, on maybe how we get to integralism. Okay. So if you can't really get to it, one of the cool things about ideals is they're supposed to sort of help you figure out how to arrive at them, right? And I think integralism can't do that. So that's one weakness of the ideal. But there's still plenty of people willing to say, okay, well, maybe we don't know how to get there. Maybe it's a poor guide to social reform, but it's still true. It's still the ideal. It's still the best regime. And then I go after that view of two count. So they say, integralists say, that their view is a unique moral order and a just moral order. Okay, so it's stable and just. And it's uniquely stable and just because it rests not only on our grasp of the natural moral law, but on social and institutional grace. That is, God has graced the state and society so that our knowledge of natural law and our ability to follow natural law is healed. Not entirely, but better than in, say, a society that does not have the church sort of integrated with the state in the same way. So now, why might this, they say that this regime will be kind of uniquely stable because it speaks to like the good of the whole person, people will be able to grasp and act for moral considerations and so on. And they use the term order all the time. You know, a lot of the integralists have a Substack called post-liberal order.
Okay.
And so there's a whole host of reasons I think the regime would destabilize. But one of the big problems and is that in an integralist regime, when you baptize your children, they acquire legal liabilities. So it means that they can be prosecuted for heresy or apostasy.
Oh, yeah.
So what integralism does is it makes baptism expensive.
Yeah.
Relative to like less aggressively Catholic regimes. And so the thought is like it discourages baptism. But as you discourage baptism, the number of people that come under the state's the church authorized state's authority will shrink. As people say, look, I'm going to do a secret baptism. I'm not going to tell the church, or, you know, I'm going to slightly alter the baptismal rite so that it doesn't count, you know, or I'll become another denomination or what have you. Yes, there are legal penalties, but I would rather risk those penalties than risk the penalties that come from putting myself under the control of the church. There's also the disincentive of the fact that integralism isn't dogma. And so dissenting from integralism is reasonable. And so there are going to be a lot of Catholics that are very pious, but they're opposed to integralism. And so the question is, okay, well, do you let them into the government or not? If you let them take positions of authority, they're going to dilute the regime. If you don't, then I think you have to treat them in ways where they have like weaker political rights in a way that Catholicism rejects. So you have a Catholic state, but they're just saying, look, state should be like less coercively Catholic. And so because you're going to have these disagreements that aren't necessarily what, say, follower John Rawls would call a reasonable disagreement, but it's just one that's the result, not maybe of human sin, because sin, you know, reason gets Tower of Babel, right? Like, we disagree. But it's not just that. Like, there's a lot of things in just political judgment and prudence that people are going to disagree about. And as long as integralism isn't required by dogma, there's going to be people who reject it and who think it's too violent. And they're likely to resist the system while being in completely good standing with the church. There's a whole bunch of other arguments. But in general, the idea is that integralism contains the seeds of its own destruction.
Yeah.
That the worries about the kinds of pluralism and disagreement and resistance you expect in an integralist order by its own lights will undermine the positive effects of grace and coercion that are supposed to make the system stable. So it won't just collapse. It will collapse by its own logic.
Yeah.
And what that means is, if integralism is not a stable ideal, why would we go for it? Because we're just going to end up back where we started. And so what I say is, this explains why all integralist regimes collapsed into milder Catholic establishmentarian regimes, where you don't have this tight relationship between Pope and crown. The Catholic Church is still established, but all of its coercion is based on like natural law with respect to abortion or stuff like that. And so I just say, look, Once you go to weaker Catholic regimes and you don't impose all these sort of costs and create all this sort of conflict and disagreement, you end up with what actually happened to basically every Catholic country on earth. And so I just give an explanation, you know, why this happened. Is the ideal is unstable. It's going to lead away from itself. And so it's like, well, why would you even go to it if you can't stay there, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, my first two lines on this is like integralism, like you can't get there, you can't stay there. And it's unfair, which leads to the justice argument. Yeah. That's my little slogan about it. It's like, you can't get there, you can't stay there, it's unfair. So what's unfair about integralism? Well, here's something really curious about it. What makes you a citizen of the church and subject to legal penalties, as already pointed out, is when you get baptized, even if you're an infant. Even if you're baptized as an infant and you're not raised Catholic or Christian. Like if you're a baptized Jew and you're raised Jewish, someone baptizes you like in secret or something, you're a citizen of the church. Sorry.
No worries.
Hold on a second.
Okay. All right.
So going back. So regardless of whether you're even a Christian, if you're validly baptized, you're a citizen of the church, subject to all the rights and responsibilities thereof. So what baptism has to do is it's not just transformative for us in becoming part of the body of Christ. It has to serve what I call as a moral transformer. The integralists say that you can't coerce people into the faith. You can't forcibly baptize people. You can't use religious coercion on the unbaptized, but you can use it on the baptized. And the only way to explain why coercion goes from unjust, why religious coercion goes from unjust to just, is to explain it by way of baptism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so what I say is, let's grant everything the Catholic Catechism teaches about baptism for the sake of argument. It still doesn't explain why coercing the unbaptized is wrong, but coercing the baptized is okay.
Yeah.
So it's an unjust treatment, and this is interesting, of people in the church, not just outside of the church, right? Yeah. It's the people in the church, or like the people that are Muslim in an Islamist regime, that are subject to all of these really strong constraints. And I think there's no way to solve this kind of what I call the baptism dilemma, which is, again, baptism supposed to make religious coercion okay. And there's just no way it can do that.
Yeah. I don't know if this is part of your argument. It doesn't seem like it is, but there would be citizens who were baptized as infants who it was not their choice to be baptized, who are subject to these laws against their own volition. Like they're like, hey, look, I didn't have any control over that. I exist as baptized without my own consent.
Yep.
Does that play any what role? I'm sure Catholic theology has
it's an important role because it's what actually raises a lot of the most important objections. Because one thing people don't understand about integralism is how key the theology of baptism is to the view.
Okay.
If you didn't baptize infants, actually, it would be far less objectionable because everyone would have to agree to be part of it. Of course, but since people reasonably disagree, you'd never be able to get everyone to agree to integralism, and so it wouldn't work. This is one reason you can't get Protestant integralism very easily, because either they don't baptize infants, or they do, but it doesn't do what Catholicism has traditionally thought that it does. So that's why, like, Protestantism is more friendly to liberalism. It's really hard to get integralism off the ground within Protestantism.
Oh yeah, and even in a strong form like Lutheranism, you can still opt out. You can leave your baptism.
Yeah. So I mean, you can get integralism of a kind in Eastern Orthodoxy too, but it's kind of weaker, and we don't really have time to get into the details of Symphonia and all these kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So this baptism of people, of infants that are raised non-Christian, is a really big deal. And it's a big deal because this was actually a huge problem in practice in the medieval period, in particular because of the mistreatment of the Jews. And because Jews were treated so badly as potential threats to social order because they rejected Christ and wouldn't assimilate, right? Many Jews would get baptized, but not sincerely. Or their children would be baptized against their wills because, you know, someone just like violated their rights as parents. And then there's all these problems. So a lot of people, also they weren't allowed to leave the faith. So people don't know this, but the Spanish Inquisition focused mostly on conversos, who were Jews who had converted to Christianity, but no longer believed, or who were baptized as infants but didn't believe. So there were unbaptized Jews that were persecuted, but many focus was on bringing people back into the fold. Yeah. This norm still exists in Islam. I mean, if you leave Islam, your family can ostracize you in many cases, but in some cases, it's believed to be a capital crime.
Yeah.
It's treason, right? And so again, integralism looks a little bit like Islamism.
Yeah.
But this issue of becoming a member at birth does raise a lot of these problems, but it's essential to be an alternative to liberalism, because if you're not bringing in people at birth and you're bringing them in by consent, you've like given the game away to liberal.
Yeah.
So that's a really important feature of integralism, is its theology of baptism, and particularly its political theology of baptism.
Mm.
That in an integralist regime, baptism is a little bit like birthright citizenship. I call it second birthright citizenship, right? Your second birth, you're a citizen now of church and state in a special, and a super citizen in a way of the state, and that you come under a particular code. This wasn't so destabilizing the medieval period, because the peasants didn't know anything, right? And they weren't mobile, and they didn't have any media access.
Hmm.
And even then, integralism was extremely unstable because of the fights between Pope and Crown.
Yeah.
So like the integralist favorite case of an integralist regime is the reign of St. Louis. It was King Louis IX of France in the 13th century. This is also the period where like Aquinas is operating in Paris and so on.
It's a golden age, yeah.
Yes. And you know, you get Dante a century later. It's like it's this high point. Architecture, art, theology, yeah. Philosophy, all this stuff. You know, one of St. Louis's advisors becomes Pope Clement IV. And so they have this like super tight relationship, and it's like, oh, that was great. Within 35 years, that was gone. Philip the Fair and Boniface VIII were enemies. Philip the Fair tried to kill Boniface VIII. Boniface VIII tried every way he could to excommunicate Philip. They were fighting over all kinds of stuff. Like, for instance, whenever a cleric would commit a crime, Philip IV wanted them to be tried in a criminal, ordinary civil court.
Yeah.
And Boniface said, no, we try them in canonical courts. This is none of your business. Mm-hmm. This is a huge fight between them. It's a very big deal.
Yeah.
So if you take the best case, and 35 years later, in the medieval period, where everybody is Catholic, basically, it's unstable even then. Yeah, so that's why you got to do the history in order to sort of understand the view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm having flashbacks to one of my professors, John Woodbridge, saying Philip the Fourth of France. He'd always say, "Philip, you got to focus on Philip the Fourth of France." Like, is that right? Was he of France?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Good. Just making sure I got that right, Dr. Woodbridge.
Yeah. No. It's fine. It's really striking. You know, the economist Mark Koyama, is a kind of economic historian, and he makes the argument for when integralist like regimes were stable were when the power of church and state were roughly equal in terms of influence. So like before then, in the early Middle Ages, you know, the Western Roman Empire has collapsed. States are very small and weak. Church doesn't fool with them. The church provides a lot of services indirectly by taking over much of the state capacity of the empire, right? Dioceses were Roman imperial jurisdictions, Pontifex Maximus named Caesar. And so, you know, they're just taking over because there's no state capacity.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to Philip the Fair, the French crown is powerful enough to ignore the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to do so in a lot of ways. And then as the other states start to congeal in Europe, then they just ignore the Pope too. And then by the Reformation, you know, it's on, right? So, so you can only really get integralism to work when the integration of church and state is in both sides' interest, because they have equal power. And so they can come up with policy bargains. So like, St. Louis could say, oh, you support me and legitimize me as monarch, and I will burn 20,000 Talmuds for you, which is, you know, basically he did burn 20,000 Talmuds in part.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, in any event, that's part of the stability argument, but that's one of the reasons it's important to attend to the history and the economic incentives and all those kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like the book. I commend it to folks. I'll leave a link in the description. So if you guys want to pick that up, do that.
And it's cheap for a book like this. So it's $15 on Kindle. You go through my website to Oxford, you can get it with the discount code built into the link for $21.
That's awesome. Have you thought about the fact that some folks will point to this book as the reason they became integralists? You know, like it's just going to happen, right?
Yeah, it is. And I'm perfectly content with it. And I'll say this publicly, you know, maybe for the first time, but you know, I defend integralism for 60 pages before I criticize it for 110.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to be fair to integralists. But I'm also getting trying to get non-integralist Catholics to take integralism seriously intellectually, because I think it has a certain unity and coherence and elegance. It's a bit like act utilitarianism and ethics. Like, it's really internally consistent. Like, what should you do? The good, right? But it also has like these hideous moral implications, like both of these views.
Yeah.
And so I want integralism around in the same way that I want act utilitarians around. I want them around intellectually because you learn a lot from engaging the view, but I don't want them anywhere near power. I don't want Peter Singer in power, and I don't want Adrian Vermeule in power.
Yeah.
So what I hope is that people will sort of come on and they'll see, oh, you know, look, this is kind of a matter of theological and political reflection than it is like a program where we take over the U.S. government. So, you know, if there are more integralists, but there are fewer integralists that are completely opposed to American constitutional order, that's fine with me, too. But it is certainly true that whenever you try to make a view look serious, which I do, that you risk that people will come to that view. My hope is that in time, you know, the Christian political theology community grows and we're able to articulate lots of very sophisticated alternatives that are based on past figures, but also modern information. So this is why I try to synthesize the kind of philosophical theology, historic philosophy of religion with contemporary politics, economics, history, so on. And I'm trying more than anything, and this is, I think, what get your viewers maybe really interested in the book, even if they're not interested in the specifics, is I'm trying to lay out how an analytic political theology would proceed.
Mm-hmm.
What would its methods be? How would we determine whether a political theology was true or false? Do we only need philosophy? Do we only need theology? Do we need both? Do we need history? Do we need economics? Do we need comparative religion? Mm-hmm. I say we need all of them.
Yeah.
And so I try to make it clear. But I think that's what's interesting, because, I mean, if you're interested in thinking through your political views, particularly as a Christian, I'm hoping to kind of provide you with a way that you might do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's you give five questions to ask religious traditions towards the end. And you also go and you touch on Sunni Islam and Chinese Confucianism, too.
That's
so
right.
It's not just integralism.
It's not just Catholic.
And that's important. It's an important case study, but it's also, you know, on the rise. So I really appreciate it. And I hope this isn't your only time on, man. You got to come back on and school me on political philosophy. This has been great.
Oh, no, I'd love to come back. I mean, my long-term plans are to now begin to construct an alternative political theology. So awesome. I plan to be in this space for a long time.
Awesome.
So
the Valier option. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll have time to talk about it. Awesome. I've got lots of thoughts and essays floating around, so.
Awesome. Well, that's going to have to do it for now, folks.
Yep.
Do check the link in the links in the description to find more from Dr. Kevin Valier. And this has been Parker's Pensies. As always, all glory to God.